Welcome to The Reason Podcast. I'm Zach Weissmuller. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes. On today's podcast, I talk with several marijuana experts who all offer slightly different perspectives on cannabis legalization. There's Lynn Lyman of the Drug Policy Alliance, a group that was instrumental in the passage of California's recent recreational marijuana initiative. Diane Goldstein of the Law Enforcement Action Partnership told us how police and prison guards are reacting to legalization, while Kenny Morrison of the California Cannabis Manufacturers Association gave us insight into the multi-billion dollar legal marijuana industry. And finally, Jeffrey Chen, a researcher at UCLA, talked about the cutting edge of marijuana science. We recorded this panel in front of a live audience on 420 at Reason's Los Angeles headquarters. We were also live streaming the talk to Reason's Facebook page, so you'll hear me take some questions from our online audience. Which reminds me, you should follow Reason on Facebook if you'd like to participate in these events in the future. And now, please enjoy the conversation. Hi, we had an interesting election. We have a new president, a new attorney general, who we'll be talking about a little bit later. But we also saw four states legalize, including California, commercial marijuana, three more medical marijuana, and that brings the total up to 28 states plus the District of Columbia that have, in one form or another, legalized marijuana, which more than half the country. That's pretty amazing. There was just a poll today, actually, from CBS that found that 61% of Americans now favor recreational marijuana legalization. That's all-out legalization. When you get into questions of medical and should we leave it to the states, the numbers are even higher. So with that stage set, how are you feeling about the prospect of marijuana legalization in our current political moment? And we'll start with you, Lynn.
All right. Thanks, Zach. Great to be here with you again. I'm feeling pretty anxious. And the San Francisco Chronicle called it, I was the bummer tent. today in their paper, but, there's so much uncertainty. And we've really... We have so much to do just within the state to implement Prop 64. There are many forces trying to undo just about every piece of Prop 64. So just defending it within our state is a battle. And then, of course, under Prop 64, there's a lot of local control. So we have 480 cities who are trying to, ban it or, otherwise make it nearly impossible. And then, of course, the biggest threat is from the federal government with Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who... is way back reefer madness type, and he's gonna be coming for California, and so we have a bill, Assembly Bill 1578, to prevent any local resources, local law enforcement working with the federal government to interfere with any marijuana activity that's legal under California law. So it won't stop everything because the feds can still come in on their own and shut people down and seize assets and whatnot. But for the most part, they can't do that much without the locals. So if that bill passes, then we'll have a little more protection.
So it's fair to say you're in a kind of cautious vigilance type mindset right now.
Yeah.
By the way, if you're watching on Facebook, we will be taking questions. So leave those in the comments section. Diane, what's your read of the current political situation in terms of marijuana legalization?
There's several things, and I think I have some significant concerns coming from the law enforcement angle. As I spent a career in law enforcement, I ran a narcotics unit, I retired as a lieutenant commander. And I think one of the things that is the most telling is in this issue of, for example, AB 1578, is the significant pushback from law enforcement agencies like the California Police Chiefs, the Narcotics Officers, the California Sheriff's Association, that quite frankly is very hypocritical. So the California Sheriff's Association has taken a very strong stance, and the Sheriff of Kern County, Youngblood, has basically already said many mischaracterizations and falsehoods about the bill. And so in one article that I read, he said that this bill would not allow law enforcement to work with the federal government. And that's completely false and inaccurate. And so for me, my role in my organization is I do a lot of pushback against the proper role of governance in this issue. And I just find it disingenuous that Sheriff Youngblood, on one hand, publicly chastised Lieutenant Governor Newsom over his gun control measure. And I'm not wanting to talk about guns and marijuana and the Second Amendment. So his attack was that this ballot initiative basically was an attack on the Second Amendment. But then he blatantly ignores the rule of law on the 10th Amendment, and that the states have every right to design our own drug policy, and the federal government, by SCOTUS rulings, can't compel states to enforce federal law. So what this bill would do is basically protect the states' rights and our ability to not use our resources, like Lynn said, to help the federal government, because everybody has to understand the only way the federal government can crack down on a state-compliant industry is with the help of local and state law enforcement. Federal government does not have the resources to attack every state, every city, every region. And so we have to do everything that we possibly can to put up a barrier to disincentivize our local law enforcement from working with them. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't places we should be working with them. So illicit grows in our state and national parks. We can continue from a law enforcement perspective to work with the federal government to remove cartel grows. Or if you have licensed operators that are actually diverting out of state, it doesn't stop us from cooperating when there's violations, significant violations of law that are criminal in nature.
And are you optimistic that we will begin to see some of that cooperation, or is it pretty bleak under the current?
You know, it depends. I think we have a lot of innovative law enforcement agents, law enforcement leaders that are starting to come out, not necessarily agencies. And it's a case-by-case basis. You know, is you have cities like Oakland or San Francisco or Richmond or West Hollywood, even in Los Angeles County Sheriff's, has left a properly and sensibly regulated market alone because their experience shows that it doesn't increase crime, that in fact that it helps neighborhoods where dispensaries are at. And so I think we just need to continue to push back on the fallacies and the falsehoods that's perpetuated by prohibitionists.
And Kenny, as an entrepreneur, what is your read of the current political situation? Are you optimistic that the industry is going to kind of power through this, or are there severe roadblocks along the way?
I think the overarching, you know, broader arc here is one of optimism. But like Lynn stated, there's reason to be cautious and anxiety in the short term, and there's still a lot that needs to be worked out in those smaller kind of story arcs. I'm real grateful for the work people like Lynn and Diane have done making sure Prop 64 passed. And I think we're lucky that the social justice components of that law went into effect the day it was voted into existence. Me as someone in the industry, I still think the social justice stuff almost trumps my own concerns. Me and the industry, we're still at a point now where some of the regulations and the fine print still is being sorted out. And the fact that Prop 64 largely dictates the non-medical side of things rather than MCRSA, which was voted in by the legislature last year, which oversees kind of the rules and regulations for the medical side of things. We're at a state now, we're at a point now where those two different frameworks need to be harmonized into a unitary system. Right. So you have a lot of special interests, you know, bickering and angling for what aspects of which one gets turned into one unitary system. So we don't have two redundant systems. And kind of one of the newest wrinkles in this whole thing is because of the rhetoric from the Trump administration and Sessions and so forth. Governor Brown, in his trailer bill, has recommended that we have we disallow the co-location of licenses. So as a manufacturer or a retailer or as a cultivator, you have to choose if your facility is going to serve the medical market or the non-medical market. And that was something that we, when we look at other states, that was something from the beginning, a trap we didn't want to fall into was having unnecessary redundancy. And so this was kind of the newest thing that, you know, some people didn't see coming, was the fact that the rhetoric we're hearing from the federal administration is actually forcing us into potentially exploring the idea of unnecessary redundancy in the marketplace and the system. So for those reasons, yeah, there's some reason to be anxious and definitely some reasons to be vigilant and keep fighting and keep working on things with all the stakeholders.
And Jeffrey, from a research standpoint, what's your big picture read of the situation at this moment?
Sure, yeah. So I think in terms of the current administration rolling back states' efforts, I think Trump has made certain statements that medical use he's okay with. And so on that end, at least the medical patients or states with medical-only laws and not necessarily adult use are arguably safer from that standpoint. In terms of the research initiatives, nothing too much has changed. Cannabis is still a Schedule I drug. It's very difficult to do research with. What has changed are a few things, one of which is Prop 64 actually creates a new avenue of funding for cannabis research, $10 million a year to public universities. And again, this is we're at a time where the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which maintains the monopoly on cannabis grown for research purposes, doesn't fund therapeutic research just because it's not the mission of their institute. They research drugs of abuse. And so having this pipeline of $10 million a year from the state of California is pretty phenomenal in going towards these research initiatives. And what we're also seeing is unrelated to any state or federal government, we're seeing foundations and philanthropists actually stepping forward and donating to cannabis research. So in Australia, there was a historic $34 million gift to the University of Sydney to create their medical cannabis research center. Mm-hmm. And we also see foundations like the Alzheimer's Foundation, the Lupus Foundation, the Epilepsy Foundation starting to advocate and fund research into the therapeutic potential of cannabis. Now, going back to at the federal level, the one good thing that has happened on that end is despite cannabis still being a Schedule I drug, the DEA has at least announced the end to the monopoly on cultivation for research purposes. So University of Mississippi has been the sole organization in America for the past 50 years allowed to cultivate cannabis for research purposes. And whenever you have a monopoly, consumers suffer because there's no incentive to be efficient or do a good job or respond to the needs of those around you. So now that the DEA has announced this, theoretically universities or potentially even current cannabis growers could technically apply to be contracted growers for NIDA for research purposes. And this would really allow for more cannabis to get into the hands of researchers to do research with. And if you look at over the past year, NIDA has actually increased, or sorry, the University of Mississippi, their cannabis farm there, they've actually increased the amount of cannabis grown by 20-fold because they realized there was about to be a massive desire from researchers to look at this. And I actually just came from UCLA. We had our inaugural cannabis research symposium at the School of Medicine, and the university is on fire about this because for once the funding is there. Wow. They've wanted to do research, just the funding has never been there. And it's so much red tape that a lot of these researchers are, before they even get started, they're defeated. There's no funding, and why do I have to go through all this red tape? So some stuff coming from the state that's definitely very positive for cannabis research. A few things happening at the federal level that's good for the research side. And then the private sector has really risen up to really fund some of these research endeavors.
While we're on that topic, could you just give us a sense of how difficult is it to study marijuana at this point? Like what kind of hoops do you have to go through and how are these changes gonna make it that much easier?
Sure. So in 1970, we passed the Controlled Substances Act here in America under the Nixon administration, as I'm sure you're all aware. And ever since then, cannabis has been listed as a Schedule I drug, which by definition have high potential for abuse and no currently accepted medical use. And it's remained in that category for the last 50 years, alongside drugs like heroin and LSD. And in contrast, drugs like cocaine, opium, and methamphetamine are Schedule II drugs. So definitionally, the federal government considers them to have less abuse potential and more medical use than cannabis, which is a Schedule I drug. So with Schedule I drugs, you have to get a Schedule I drug license, which often can take up to years to get that license. Once you do have that license, you have to adhere to all of the stringent requirements of that research. It has to be stored in a very specific way. The safe that you use has to be up to a certain code. The handling procedures have to be a certain way. There has to be a chain of custody. The DEA does background checks on all of the members in the study who might come into contact with the cannabis. They have to do site inspections. They have to make sure that the floor under the safe is strong enough that nobody can drill through it, for example, to rob the contents of the safe. It's a lot of red tape. And you're talking to researchers who are used to working unencumbered. So to have a researcher have to do all of this, a lot of them are defeated before they even get started. And then that's just getting the Schedule I drug license and getting DEA approval. You still have to order the cannabis from NIDA. And up until maybe a year ago, they didn't have any high CBD strains. And the cannabis from NIDA is very different than any cannabis you might find in a dispensary today. It's the THC content is 3 to 4 times lower. It's devoid of pretty much all other cannabinoids. Up until recently, it was devoid of all of the cannabinoids. And the terpene content is pretty low, virtually none. And so the real question is, researchers go through all this effort to then study something that doesn't look like anything like what's happening in the real world. So does it make a lot of sense at that point for a lot of these researchers to go through that? And then we talked about, obviously, the difficulties with funding. And until recently, there were even more layers of approval. You need something called the Public Health Service Review from the Department of Health and Human Services. A year and a half ago, the Obama administration removed that. But that was just an example of another layer of approval that would add however many months to your study. And to end this, the current PTSD study with Sue Sicily in the University of Pennsylvania, that was funded by the multidisciplinary, funded by MAPS. Mm-hmm. That was a study that took, I believe, 6 or 7 years to get off the ground because of all the regulatory hurdles. When the study was ready to go, they went to NIDA to order the cannabis. They didn't have the right ones available. They didn't have any CBD cannabis ready. So that's kind of been where we've been for the past 50 years.
And I want to talk a little bit more later about, you know, what are some of the more promising areas of research in this field. But first, I want to ask you, Lynn, the Drug Policy Alliance was a very important player in terms of Prop 64, which is the California legalization initiative that passed. And it's the largest scale legalization of recreational marijuana so far. So it matters outside of this state because a lot of people are going to be looking at what this huge market, what emerges in this huge market. So in broad strokes, what exactly did Prop 64 accomplish? And when can we expect to see a real above board market emerge?
So it's a 62-page initiative, so there's a lot in there. Let me try to give you the highlights. There's the criminal justice pieces that Kenny mentioned, so let me just name a few of those. We reduced or eliminated all marijuana offenses on the books other than selling cannabis to children. Mm-hmm. And there's a few other things that are really outside of the scope that remain felonies. Everything else has been reduced to a misdemeanor, an infraction, or altogether legalized. And it's applicable retroactively. So about 6,000 people still in California jails for one of these marijuana charges are now applying for relief. That went into effect immediately at midnight on election night, are applying to be resentenced and released. Over 1 million Californians have a marijuana record, and they can now have that record cleared pretty much automatically, filling out some paperwork. We have about, in the first 2 months, about 2,000 people filed for that paperwork. Mm. And the other huge piece of the decriminalization was that we ended arrest of children in California for marijuana offenses. A child will never be arrested again in this state. And you may know that's the way kids get into the criminal justice system is through a marijuana offense. So we are hoping that this puts a big dent in the school-to-prison pipeline. So those were some of the criminal justice pieces, and those took effect immediately. everything that had to do with commercial regulation and licensing doesn't take effect until January of 2018. Mm. And so the state is actually required. You may have heard that there's going to be a delay with licensing, but under California law, the state is required to begin licensing by January 1st, 2018. It doesn't mean they're going to hand out all the licenses at that time. We expect them to start smaller and maybe do some provisional licensing, some emergency licensing. But once we begin to license, then we begin to collect the revenue. Mm. And that's really the other big part of this initiative is the revenue. And it's expected to raise about $1 billion a year. And that revenue is going to a number of critical issues in California right now. One of them is environmental restoration from the illegal marijuana grows in the public parks. Another one is drug treatment. We haven't had sufficiently funded drug treatment in California for about 20 years since DPA's initiative in 2000. And then the other piece is for the first time ever, in addition to the research money, and there is research money specifically for medical and then more broadly for legalization. But in addition to that, we put in a first-of-its-kind community reinvestment fund. So $50 million a year will go back to those communities that have been the most targeted and hit the hardest by the war on drugs. So communities that have been decimated with arrests and incarcerations over the years and had their families ripped apart. And so those communities will be first in line to receive that money. But we have to begin licensing so that we can actually collect the revenue, and that's going to happen in January.
Great. And as that starts to happen, Kenny, and it's, you know, it's going to be this mixture of state and local authorities implementing this. What do you hope that, and as you mentioned, there has to be a kind of reconciliation between the medical regime and the recreational regime. So what do you hope that regulators get right? Like, what's the most important thing for them to get right? And what are some of the pitfalls, you know, from a manufacturer's perspective that you really hope they avoid?
I think broadly, the most important thing from my perspective to get right is I think it's important for as many people that are operating in the pre-regulatory market to transition into the regulated market, right? If we have people who are operating today who are looking at January 2018 as their date of retirement or their date of going back underground or staying underground, shall I say, then I think there's still more work to do. I think transitioning the existing industry is kind of top priority, right? Because we're trying to end the war on drugs to some degree here. Mm-hmm. So
would that involve just not creating too much bureaucracy and red tape for them to navigate, or just issuing enough licenses?
Finding the sweet spot on taxation,
right.
You know, making sure that the state is willing to license more people rather than not so many people.
Okay.
I mean, there's a lot of work to do. Yeah.
Can I just respond? I think what Kenny's saying is so important, and it's often overlooked. Mm-hmm. California is the only state that's legalized that had a 20-year industry. So it's not like we're starting from, you know, a 3 or 4 year industry the way, you know, they may have been in Colorado, or a 2 year industry as it was in Washington.
Right.
We've been doing this for 20 years. And so we have to transition. Otherwise, we are telling this huge number of people who have worked in this industry when it was unregulated and dangerous and taking high risks that they have to stay underground, and we won't be able to tax the product. We won't have dealt with any of the public safety issues. Mm. We won't have safe products for consumers. So all of the intentions behind regulation will be undermined if we don't help people transition.
From a public safety standpoint, I think what both Kenny and Lynn say are really incredibly important. For me, the sensible sweet spot on taxation, I think, is an issue. And what I liked about 64, it's the lowest tax rate across all the other states. But the problem is local control. And so, for example, you know, in the city of Costa Mesa, because I live in Orange County, I just saw an article that the licensing and regulatory process that they're proposing for a manufacturing facility, like one cost was $27,000 and the other one was over 20,000. And so that's not going to help public safety. Mm. That's going to just encourage the illicit market. And so we need to be able to go back and educate our city council people, our county board of supervisors, that if you overregulate, you're not going to have the effect on the illicit market that we should. And then the other issue is, you know, when you start talking about the differences between the MCRSA, the medical marijuana regulations, and Prop 64, is the police chiefs and the sheriffs continue to want to exclude people who have had felony arrests previously for cultivation. Yeah. And I think that's also wrong as well, because that will continue to feed the illicit market. And so law enforcement's response is to overregulate, and that's not going to help public safety.
It sort of puts the people at a disadvantage who created the industry from participating in it, right? We set, we created the template. We kind of, our business types were the ones that were validated by the creation of these license types. But then certain people are saying, but you can't hold a license. So, you know, there's something that needs to be figured out there.
And do you get the sense, Diane, that the law enforcement agencies and lobbies are just going to fight this tooth and nail to the very end, or are people coming around?
Well, I think that the big issues, we have to look at the history of California. You know, 1996, we passed Prop 215, and I was a police officer then, and this was exactly what our law enforcement agency did, is they, our city attorney created a ban, and they said, we don't care what the voters want. We're going to take people's cannabis away, and we're going to force them to go to court, and we're going to make them bring their doctors in order to get cases dismissed. Mm-hmm. And so they aren't quite as obvious at this point or as overt, because what the California police chiefs will tell you is, we support the appropriate regulation of medical marijuana, yet they set up all these barriers that undermine the successful implementation of the emerging industry. And I think what's been very interesting from my perspective, though, is we've actually had more wins than losses in drug policy in the last 6 years. Yes, is the criminal justice lobby is incredibly powerful. I wrote an article during Prop 64, and I pulled out just five of the law enforcement lobby organizations, the NARCs, the chiefs, the California Correctional Supervisors, and PORAC, and one other. And they had, in the last 10 years, spent close to $10 million on lobbying and paying lobbyists. So that, to me, is a use of indirect and direct taxpayer dollars to undermine what we, the people, want to accomplish. And I think law enforcement lobbying is unethical, and it goes against the grain of where we've been placed into the executive branch of our government, where we're supposed to not make the laws, because we are the only people outside of the military that are allowed to kill people. You don't give us the power to make the laws. We're only supposed to enforce them.
Great point. We have a question from Facebook for Jeffrey, I believe. It's from Rachel Brenneman. She says, from a person who wavers on the issue of recreational marijuana, what have you found out about the long-term effects of daily marijuana usage? Can cognition and decision-making abilities be harmed by long-term marijuana use?
Yeah, so this is a question that's brought up a lot in the scientific community. And the difficulty in answering this question is that there certainly, in any sort of a study, you're looking at this from an observational standpoint. And it's always hard to tease apart correlation and causation. And the studies are often conflicting too. For every study that shows that people who use cannabis for a long period of time have drops in IQ, you might see another study in a different country looking at a different population that might say, we don't really see that measurable amount of IQ. So it's really hard when you're trying to compare these studies, because, again, you're looking at different countries. The methodology of these studies are very different. And at the end of the day, even when we do see certain studies pointing towards harms, it's very hard to tease apart correlation and causation. Is it that is it that 20 years of cannabis smoking led to those IQ drops? Well, often cannabis use is often comorbid with tobacco use, alcohol use, and use of other drugs as well. And so it's really hard to tease apart what's actually causing this. And so there is currently a large longitudinal study that's embarking in the U.S. It's called the MIND study, and it's being run out of Harvard. And it's supposed to be a 10-year longitudinal study that is actually able to kind of measure these sample points over time. And we'll have data when that study, I think that study is still pretty early on in its 10-year span, so we'll have some results from there. But I guess the takeaway that I've really gotten from the scientific community is that certainly a lot of the harms, especially a lot of the harms that we were led to believe decades ago, are overblown. It's certainly not harmless, but at least that a lot of the harms that we might have heard when we were growing up have certainly been overblown. At the end of the day, we just don't know. That's really the
yes.
So a couple things on this issue of long-term effect. First of all, I think that for those of us who use cannabis every day, as I do, it hasn't had any long-term effect, and mm-hmm. I think I get smarter every day.
Me too, Lynn.
Thank you. But the other thing that we have to really look at, and I hope that the research, and I think it must go there, is the issue of tolerance, mm-hmm. which is distinct with THC from every other psychoactive drug, how THC works in the system. And so the more that you use, the more the effects change and in many ways diminish, particularly mm-hmm. the effects that people might be more worried about, like mm-hmm. feeling dizzy or paranoid or mm-hmm. whatever it may be. So as you become a daily user, those effects really diminish. And so these studies have to not just look at, this one-time use, but, people who use over time, and how is that different than someone who uses once a week or once a month?
And on the flip side of that question, we're talking about harms. Another open question is the possible benefits that mm-hmm. Medical cannabis has. And this was something that was kind of laughed off by Jeff Sessions, the new attorney general. He kind of laughed at the idea that it could be an effective treatment for chronic pain and possibly even a substitute for opioids. It's a hot topic right now because there's an issue with opioids. What do you make of that? What are some of the promising areas for medical and what do you make of the kind of whole opioid cannabis issue?
Let me jump in sure. real quick because literally this week, 420 is great because you always get great 420 news about a lot of the really positive things that are going on. There was a couple researchers this last year that did a study on Medicare costs associated in medical marijuana states that were really promising, but they focused mainly on seniors. So they just released a study on Medicaid recipients who in medical marijuana states and costs associated with running the programs. And what they saw is in states with Medicaid that they are seeing as well significant cost savings because there's been a huge reduction in Medicaid prescriptions. And in fact, I brought the article that anti-nausea drug prescriptions fell by 17%, antidepressants by 13%, prescriptions for seizure and psychosis drugs also fell 12%. And so when you start talking about, for me, from a policy perspective, is what's the role of governance? Is, a medical marijuana industry can help us save healthcare costs that are significant, that are less damaging. We are now seeing studies relative to the use of cannabis as an exit drug for opioids, as a substitution that is beneficial into easing our heroin and our opioid prescription issues. So I think that there are going to be benefits, and I think that research and science is going to be the way that we're going to see those positive outcomes.
Yeah, definitely. To add to that, there was a study that came out last year that we're all familiar with, showing about a 25% drop in opioid overdoses in states that had medical marijuana programs. And in clinical trials, in controlled clinical trials using NIDA cannabis, this is actually data that was presented at our symposium early today, the work of Dr. Ziva Cooper out of Columbia, you actually see that cannabinoids have an opioid-sparing effect. And that is, you need to achieve a similar level of analgesia, which is reduction in pain. If you have, let's say you normally needed 10 units of an opioid, you might need only 2 units of the opioid.
Wow.
And then you add cannabinoids and you can actually create a similar level of analgesia. And the effects aren't additive, they're synergistic. So it's not 1 + 1 = 2,
yeah.
It's actually 1 + 1 = 3 or 4. And so this opioid sparing property of cannabinoids is starting to get pretty well fleshed out in the literature. And as you all know, there was the National Academy of Sciences released kind of a landmark report. And one of their strongest conclusions was that there was pretty definitive evidence that cannabinoids and cannabis can be used for chronic pain. And you don't see, and I know you talked about the issue of tolerance, and I know at least you know with opioids you also get a really rapid rise in tolerance that you don't, and it, but the, it's that effect is not as robust with cannabinoids, whereas opioids you have to continuously escalate to get the same pain relieving effects, which often leads to overdose or leads to drug-seeking behavior, and sometimes patients move on to heroin.
Yeah. In Washington, the number one question that's being reported in the so-called adult use market, it's a term that I struggle with, and I'll get into that in a second, is the top two questions that the bud tender is asked is, mm-hmm. what will help me with my sleep? Mm-hmm. What will help me with my pain? Mm-hmm. So to the woman who said she's kind of on the fence about whether or not, you know, so-called non-medical adult use, social use, mm-hmm. you know, whatever term you want to put on it, how she feels about that. I think the terms medical use and recreational use are both a little belabored, mm-hmm. because how would you categorize a massage? How would you categorize yoga?
Wellness.
Right. Is it medical or is it recreational? It's
yeah.
it's a different way of thinking about your well-being.
Yeah, the boundaries aren't as clear
yeah.
as that, yeah.
And the fact we heard for so long that, oh, you know, medical use, that's just a slippery slope to out and out legalization.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in a state like Colorado, we see both of those systems, you know, both uses really coexisting side by side very, very well. And if medical use was a slippery slope to out and out legalization, medical use would have disappeared. Mm-hmm. And it's not. If anything, when people come into a so-called non-medical store asking, what will help me with my sleep, what will help mm-hmm. me with my pain, the adult use market is actually reinforcing the yep. notion of cannabis as a therapeutic mm-hmm. wellness model.
And, you know, when we talk about the science that Jeffrey brought up and that Diane was talking about, these are scientific studies that are apparently just being ignored by the top law enforcement officer
yeah.
in America. Yet Trump himself on the campaign trail was a little more ambivalent about it. He seemed to be saying, you know, medical, yeah, let's do medical. Everything else, we'll leave it to the states. Then we have his spokesperson, Sean Spicer, kind of saying we're going to have a crackdown, but then backing off that. You know, when we think back to the Obama administration, he seemed very friendly to legalization during the campaign, but then had a big crackdown in the early years. So do we have any predictions in terms of what the Trump administration is going to do here?
Well, there's one area that we don't have to predict because it's already happening, and that is deporting immigrants for marijuana use.
Mm.
And we're talking about, you know, permanent residents, green card holders can be deported just for admitting to use. Having a medical card is indicating your guilt that you have used cannabis and you can and will be deported. 1 in 6 people who are deported from this country are deported for marijuana. I mean, it's crazy. So that's already happening.
Yeah.
And the Secretary of Homeland Security, I think just yesterday
John
or
Kelly.
The day before, John Kelly, said, oh, yes, we will absolutely use marijuana as a reason for deportation. So that piece is already
yeah.
happening. But I think the what we're going to see is in a so I'll get to Trump and Sessions in a moment, but the biggest concern we have for places where we have legalized is the continued criminalization of people who use in public. Mm-hmm. Because we didn't legalize use in public, because that would have been impossible. We would not right. have been able to pass an initiative. And so right now it's only legal to use in a private space, you know, here in a business or in your home. And so the people who don't have private spaces tend to be poorer people. And so we are worried, and we've seen it in Colorado, huge rises in D.C. as well, in ticketing people for public consumption. And that is the beginning of the criminalization of people. So that is also continuing to happen. I think our biggest worry with Sessions, I mean, Trump, again, I don't think he has a big position on this, but I think he's going to let Sessions do what he wants to do, and that's who we need to be watching. And I have every reason to believe that Sessions will come to California and crack down, particularly on our recreational markets. And so we are advising the state to give out two license types, regardless of how the state the system is unified or not, that there always be two license types. Because Jeff Sessions has said, you know, he'll leave medical alone for now. Mm. We're coming after recreational. And I do think that that's going to happen.
So even with these overwhelming numbers against that, you still think it's not going to stop old Jeff Sessions?
No, yeah. Not at all.
Anyone else have any thoughts on Trump and Sessions?
Jeff Sessions is a diehard Richard Nixon drug warrior that is not science-based. Is, you know, his whole ideology is a rhetorical ideology that we've been dealing with from a law enforcement perspective, you know, going back for a long time. And I think that there is pushback on him from Republicans in Congress and Democrats. I mean, there is some optimism that we can have. I mean, we have a cannabis caucus in Congress. Yes. Okay, so we need to continue to not be apathetic and to make certain that we operate not just on a local and a state level with regard to politics, but to make certain that we're calling up our senators and our congresspeople and holding them accountable and making sure they understand that we're part of that 70, you know, it's 80% that, you know, favors medical marijuana, 61 that favors adult consumption, and 71% that basically in the CBS poll said, leave the states alone. Respect the Constitution. Mm-hmm. Understand that we don't want the federal government intervening in our industry. And so is the more they hear from not just policymakers, but from the industry, mm-hmm. but from, you know, doctors, from people who have personal stories to tell about why it makes a difference. I spend time up in Sacramento a lot, and staffers and legislators love that we're there. But you know what they want to hear? They want to hear your personal story, that if you're a cancer patient, or if your dad has dementia, how that helped, or if your child has epilepsy, or if your state-compliant business was raided inappropriately by the federal government and your assets were seized. Mm-hmm. We need to make it personal and hold them accountable through voting as well.
Yes.
I want to go to some of our Facebook questions that have been coming in. Will Canada's legalization, this is from Gary Cook, will Canada's legalization have any impact on the U.S. federal policy towards legalization? Does anyone know anything about Canada?
You know, I think it's a very interesting thing because I think I saw an article that Customs and Border recognizes it, and their concern is that they need to make certain that Canadian citizens understand that marijuana will not be legal in the United States and that you can be prevented from crossing over and visiting. You know, it's very interesting. I think one of the things that is going to be a positive net gain for Canada is you may very well see Canadian tourism increase. Mm. You know, one of the things that's happened in this administration is we're seeing a significant drop in tourism into the United States right now, simply because people are concerned that they're going to get turned away at the border because of the way that we're investigating people coming into the United States, even if they're just coming in as tourists right now.
There's a question from Howard Pena, who says, in highly red states like Texas, Do you think decriminalization is needed before medical will be considered? So in those states where it seems like a long road to legalization, do you see any path forward for a place like Texas?
Absolutely. And there's a movement going on in Texas. But I don't think you have to do decrim before you do medical. I think you could do either one first, depending on where your state is at and sort of if you have a medical cannabis community, if you have those patients to tell those stories. Sometimes that's really the impetus to pass medical. If you have the data that show that mass numbers of people have been criminalized, arrested, incarcerated, then you have the pushback to get decrim. So it kind of depends on what's going on in your state. But I don't think Texas is actually that far behind us on this.
This is a more of a comment from Allison Silvis, who says, the top law enforcement officer must go by the laws, not the studies. It's up to Congress to change the laws. So any response to that idea?
Well, it is up to Congress to change the laws, but according to the 10th Amendment and a number of Supreme Court decisions going back for quite a significant period of time, literally state that the federal government cannot compel state government, local law enforcement, which is part of our state government, to, in fact, assist or investigate or implement federal drug laws. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't mean that we don't allow them into our state. They can do that, but why should we use our own taxpayer dollars to help the federal government undermine our own state constitution and our laws? And I'm a real... I think that's a real significant issue relative to the 10th Amendment. And so, yes, Congress needs to change it, and there are people in Congress that are trying to work on that right now.
And I mean, this is kind of an issue that separates the real Federalists from the fake hypocrite ones.
Yes. Yep.
The bottom line is that we are ultimately, for this tension to resolve, they are going to have to do something at the federal level.
Yes.
And, you know, take it off Schedule 1. Is there any hope of that happening anytime soon?
And Lynn probably is more familiar with a bunch of the recently enacted, they're not enacted, but that are in process. There's multiple federal bills right now that have been introduced that are looking at everything from descheduling to respect states' rights to banking.
And you know, every year, even though we've had a Republican Congress for a while now, we've actually increased our number of votes on those bills every year. And so we're running them again this year. And, you know, despite who's in charge in the White House, I think we still have a strong bipartisan block within Congress to move this forward. I don't know if we'll get a signature on anything in this administration, but I think that Congress is in as good of a place to pass this as it was last year, the year before.
Theodore Lee asks, should states be able to override the will of voters to legalize weed by making implementation conditional upon factors which voters never envisioned?
Well, if they do that, we'll take them to court because that's illegal. So, yeah, I mean, Prop 64, you know, a vote. The great thing about our voter initiative is that it is the highest law of the land. The not so great thing is it's a really expensive and exhausting way to make policy. We should be able to make policy through our legislatures, but because of political political realities and special interests, that, you know, is often difficult on complex hot button issues, and so we have to go to the ballot. But again, the great thing about that is that that is the supreme law, and so it is you know, above anything that has passed in the legislature. So when the legislature is looking to make any changes to Prop 64, you know, they have to do it within the constrictions of what we set out. And we did in Prop 64 say they could make some changes, specifically around regulations. And that's just a common sense thing. You know, there has never been in the history of the human race, there has never been a commercial cannabis market the size of California. It just hasn't happened. So the few commercial cannabis markets that now exist in the world, which is Uruguay and a handful of states here, are all less than 5 million people each. So this is the first time that any jurisdiction of this size has attempted to create this market. And so we did leave flexibility for the legislature to amend some of those regulations.
And I'd like to close out with this question. We'll just go down the line quickly with look into your crystal balls and give me your predictions for what's coming next on a macro scale with marijuana legalization or maybe drug legalization more broadly. It kind of seems like we're at a tipping point, especially with public opinion swaying totally in favor of it. More states than not legalizing it in some one sense or another. What do you expect to happen next? Like more states coming on board? Are we going to even start talking about other drugs? What do you think is next in this fight?
Can I go last?
Sure. Start with
Let's Jeffrey. Go. I have a lot. Jeffrey.
Yeah. Sure, we can start with me. Well, I think certainly the descheduling of marijuana or the rescheduling marijuana is pretty imminent. You're looking at 90% of Americans who think it should be legal for medical purposes. You're seeing a strong call from the scientific community. It's certainly the research of the cannabis needs to go forward unadulterated and uninhibited. And I think that will apply to other drugs that are Schedule I drugs that we've been trying to research MDMA and psilocybin to other notable examples. So I think marijuana will pave the way for us to have a discussion that we should at least be researching these compounds. Now how they can be regulated and how they can be how the public can have access to them is a whole different story. But it's very hard to make an argument now that we shouldn't even be researching these compounds, whether for the therapeutic effects or to understand more about the harm. So I think that's really what's imminent is the rescheduling of cannabis so that at least scientists can do work with it.
Kenny, any thoughts on where the industry is headed?
This guy kind of sort of stole my answer.
Sorry, bro.
I mean, no. So if you, I remember a few months ago on CNBC watching Pot Barons of Colorado or, some kind of sensationalized show about people making a lot of money in Colorado. Or maybe it was CNN, but it was immediately followed up with something about, the therapeutic use of psychedelics. Mm. And so I think what we're seeing is we're starting to see people being more tolerant and open to the fact of using psychedelics medicinally.
Interesting.
So just like alcohol prohibition was ended on a state-by-state basis, I think what's critically important, my organization, cannabis, is just a small part of what we do. Mm. We do total criminal justice reform and look at every single drug on that Schedule I. I can make a case for every single drug on that Schedule I to have medicinal value if it was adequately researched. I mean, if you look outside our country, you have heroin-assisted treatment programs in Switzerland and in other places, and in particular from a public safety standpoint, is in Switzerland they reduced property crime almost by 80% when they initiated a heroin-assisted treatment program based on a public health strategy. So I think where we're headed down the road is the re-innovation of public safety and taking it away from law enforcement as or criminal justice system as being the only people that are allowed to dictate it and creating a new definition, which means that it's community health and safety and that law enforcement goes back to its role of dealing with true criminals and crime prevention, and it's not just arresting people. We need to develop law enforcement into a holistic one piece of the puzzle that doesn't take away from mental health programs or public health treatments or education or every place else where we do right now.
So I think that within 10 years, we will see the outright end of marijuana prohibition. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to take us about 10 years to get there. For Drug Policy Alliance and like LEAP, we do a lot. We work on a lot of other issues outside of cannabis. Our next big campaign, which we'll be unveiling in the next couple of weeks, is all drug decriminalization. And so this is a model that has been pioneered in Portugal with incredible results. I mean, everything goes the right way. Youth use is down and treatment is up and, all of the health indicators are up. And so really everything you would want to see. And so we will be launching what we expect to be another, 10 to 20 year campaign in this country to decriminalize all drug use. We believe that absent harm to others, nobody should ever be punished for what they put into their bodies. And that's why we need all drug decrim.
Well, I'd like to thank my panel for joining us today and everyone in our live audience and our online audience. Thanks for watching. Happy 420, everyone.
I hope you enjoyed that discussion, and as I mentioned before, make sure to follow Reason on Facebook for a chance to participate in live Q&As in the future. And don't forget to rate and review the podcast on iTunes. For Reason, I'm Zach Weissmuller.